And it, we will start our vetting session. Dr. Hinman.
Thank you, President Polis. As we continue down this pathway towards potentially bringing a recommendation for a bond to you, the last effort was to go out to the community and do a survey to see what kind of interest there was in passing a bond in the city of West Covina. You have those results, so you can kind of see the raw numbers for what they are and make your own determination on that. However, we do have a group of experts here to go through those numbers with you and through their experience, and I will tell you they have significant experience in the survey. I believe they'll be able to share with you a pretty clear picture about what our pathway could be from this point forward. So that being said, I'll turn the presentation over to Dr. Coghlan.
President Polis and Board, thank you for being here tonight. When we put together, we started looking at the feasibility, we put together a team, and some of those team members are here tonight, and I want to introduce them. I'm going to introduce Tim Carty, who is with Piper Jeffrey, and is on our team. He would serve as the financial advisor when it comes to looking at the feasibility of a bond and post-bond. So I'm going to turn this over to Tim Carty from Piper Jaffray and have him make introductions after that.
Thank you very much, Dr. Coghlan. Good evening, Madam President, members of the board. I'm one of two Irish Tims that you're going to hear from this evening. So as Rob described, I'm Tim Carty, serving as the district's financial advisor. Very happy to be here. As Superintendent Hinman described, one of the steps for any school district in trying to identify is a local general obligation bond measure feasible is to conduct a public opinion survey. And I think the best in the business is the other Tim here, Dr. Tim McLarney, president of True North Research. So I'm going to turn the floor over to Tim, who's going to go through the PowerPoint, entertain any questions any of the board members may have, comments, discussion. I'll be here to facilitate, add anything that I can to be helpful. So with that, Tim, I will turn the floor over to you.
And before Tim begins, I'll just share with the board, I did receive a text from Trustee Menares, and he will be here within minutes.
Great. Good evening, Madam President, members of the board. I am Dr. Timothy Patrick McLarney, actually, since we're going to get Irish. Are you
Patrick?
The Irish lack imagination. I'm the president of True North Research, and we are a firm that over the last 15 years has specialized in working with school districts as well as other public agencies around the state in using surveys to develop a statistically reliable understanding of the communities and the customers and ultimately the voters that they serve. My business partner and I today, working as a two-person team, have designed and conducted over 900 research studies for public agencies, and about a third of the work that we do, or a little over 300 studies, are what we call revenue measure feasibility studies, similar to what we're talking about tonight, where the goal is to use the survey to understand, is it feasible to move forward with some type of revenue measure, bond, parcel tax, for example? And if it is feasible, how would you go about structuring that measure in a way that it's consistent with the type of measure that your community is interested in supporting? We have had a lot of success to date. Our research has ultimately led to about $24 billion in voter-approved measures throughout the state. And if you go back to 2008, which was the beginning of the recession, in which, as you might imagine, the challenge of passing tax measures became a lot more difficult during that environment and post that environment, we've been able to maintain a 93% success rate for measures that we recommend go to ballot. And I mention that mainly because as I go through tonight's presentation or perhaps in questions from the board, I may make reference to how the results that we're seeing here compared to what we might typically see when we do this type of research for other agencies that have gone on to have ballot measures. So I wanted you to have a sense for the experience base from which I'll be speaking. Also, as I go through the presentation, I welcome questions from the board as I go or at the end. Happy to make this a discussion. Okay? All right. Now, before we go on and talk about the actual survey results, let's take a moment to review both the purpose of the study or the why we go about doing this, as well as the methodology or the how we go about doing this. In terms of the purpose, I see these studies are really trying to meet three overarching objectives. First is that simple question of, is it feasible? And when I say feasible, what I mean is if this board were to choose to place a measure on an upcoming ballot, does it have a reasonable chance of success? Answer to that question is always yes. Right? Sometimes we do this research, and when we look at the data, we really don't see that there's a path to get you from where you are today to where you would need to be successful on election day. And if that's the case, I'm very frank about that. Right? I think the last thing that the board would want, the administration want, or the community wants is to invest in a process that really doesn't have a reasonable chance of success. When it comes to school bonds, however, and in particular schools, what we tend to find is of all the things that voters are willing to tax themselves for, schools come up the top of the list. And so when you think about a Prop 39 bond that requires 55% majority support for passage, it's often the case that we do find that it's feasible. Once you've determined it's feasible, the next question is, well, then how do we structure this measure in a way that it's consistent with our what our community is willing to support? There's a lot of components to a bond package, right? There's the price tag, what's it going to cost in terms of the aggregate bond amount, as well as the underlying tax rate, which is really the thing that voters are more sensitive to. There's all the things that you could fund. What's the project list? How are you going to spend the money? Right? Voters want to know these things when you're looking at a ballot measure. What types of accountabilities might be built into this measure to give assurances to those who are concerned about how their tax dollars are spent, that they would be well spent in this case. So there's a lot of components to a bond package, and the survey helps guide those decisions about how that measure could be best aligned with what your community is interested in supporting. And then finally, it's an opportunity to gather information needed for communications and outreach. I'm a real big advocate of, you know, if a public agency is going to take the step of putting a measure on a ballot and asking their voters to decide something, it's important and incumbent upon that agency to help educate and inform the voters about the decision you're asking them to make, right? You're not allowed as a public agency to advocate on behalf of the bond, up or down, but you certainly can inform voters about what your facility needs are and ultimately how this plan would address them, right? And that basic information like that is really important for voters to have before they go in and are asked to make a decision about a measure. Okay. On to the methodology. A survey was conducted in late May of this year. We wound up speaking with 328 voters who are what we call likely November 2016 voters. These are voters who we would expect to cast a ballot on the natural in this upcoming November ballot. In terms of how we pull that sample, we use a process called stratification and clustering. It's a fancy word for saying that we take your voter file, that likely November voter file, and we break it down by all the variables that we know are related to voting behavior, things like age, gender, partisanship, household party type, that's a big one, right? We pay a lot of attention to household party type because what we figure out is it's household party type that really shapes more than anything how people behave. And the way that works is, you know, if I know you're a Democrat, for example, I know something about you. If I know you live with another Democrat, I know a lot more about you because the household dynamic shapes how people talk about politics and the interactions. And if you're two Democrats who live together, when you talk politics, you tend to reinforce each other and you convince each other that you're correct, right? Double Republicans do the same thing on the other side. You know, if you live in a mixed household, God help you, right? You argue about politics, right? So that act of arguing about politics mitigates your behavior such that what we tend to find is on the spectrum of behavior, dual Democratic households are the most liberal, right, and the most willing to support these types of measures. And at the other end of the spectrum, you have your dual Republican households. They tend to be the most conservative and the least likely to support your measures. So we pay attention to household party type. We then build clusters in your sample that represent certain profiles, and then we randomly select people into their clusters. The reason why this is better than what they call a simple random sample, where you just choose people at random, is if we call somebody or we talk to somebody and they refuse to participate in the survey, we can replace them with someone who shares their exact same profile. And it's that profile that's so predictive of how people vote on these types of measures that allows us to be as accurate as we are, even in an age when not everybody answers their phone, right, and lots of people call screen. So in terms of the recruiting and data collection, we used a combination of methods. We used not only telephone, that's both landlines and cell phones, but also email for recruiting voters to participate in the study. And we allowed people to participate either telephone or online at a password-protected website. Now, because this was a sampling of your likely November voters and not a census of all of your likely November voters, it has what's known as a margin of error due to sampling. And in this case, that's plus or minus 5.36%. What that means is we can be 95% confident that the results I'm going to share with you today are within 5.36% of what we would have found had we spoken with all of your likely November voters. Okay. On to the results. This first slide shows the results of what we call our importance of issues question. And for each of the issues you see there on the left side of that slide, we simply ask people, how important is this to you? Is it extremely important or very important, which are represented by the dark blue and medium blue bars? Or is it somewhat important or not at all important, which is represented by that negative space off to the right? We ask this question for a couple reasons. One is it's a really nice warm-up. It just gets people thinking about local issues. But it's also an opportunity for us to understand how does education stack up against these other issues that also compete for tax dollars, things like improving public safety and maintaining local streets, for example, as well as how does that issue in particular stack up against the issue of preventing local tax increases, right? And what you see in your community is that improving the quality of education in local public schools was the number one issue, right? That was ranked at the top, followed by improving public safety, maintaining local streets and roads, and then repairing and upgrading aging school facilities, then preventing local tax increases and reducing traffic congestion. There's a gap there that you see between improving the quality of education in local public schools and preventing local tax increases. Generally speaking, the larger that gap, the better positioned you are, as you might imagine, moving forward with some type of bond or tax measure for education purposes. And that gap, in your case, is pretty typical of what we see for most school districts. The other thing I will call your attention to, though, is that issue of repairing and aging school facilities. It checks in above that preventing local tax increases one, but not by much, right? And there's two points to kind of keep in mind about that. One is that means that, hey, when you're thinking about school bonds, it is in tension to some degree with voters' interest in keeping their taxes low, so you have to be sensitive to that. But the other thing is that that relationship is very typical, that it's below improving the quality of education, right? Substantially below in terms of importance. And what that is a reminder to us that at the end of the day, voters don't care so much about buildings and facilities, right? What they care about is how are those improvements to your buildings and facilities ultimately going to impact the quality of education in the classroom. So if you choose to move forward with a bond, as you communicate about what your needs are, it's really important to connect the dots between what it is you're going to build and why it matters in the classroom, right? Because the build part isn't what voters are so interested typically in. It's how it's going to improve that classroom environment. Okay. Now, at this point, we transition right to that initial ballot test. And the idea is before we get any deeper into this interview and we start talking in more detail about what the tax rates could be for this bond measure, what the projects are that you're going to be funding, as well as arguments pro and con, we want to present to them a mock-up of what we think that approximately 75-word ballot statement could look like and get their reaction. It's a really good gauge of where your community is at on the natural with respect to this proposal. And so the language you see is shown here, pretty typical of bond ballot language these days for districts that have similar needs to yours. So there's the wording, and here are the results. So at that initial ballot test, we had 69% of voters say that they would support the measure. We had 21% who said they would oppose. And we have about 10% who said they were not sure or prefer not to answer. Obviously, in the state of California for a Prop 39 bond, you need 55% to be successful. And so right out of the gates, you're about 14 points above that 55% threshold. Now, one of the unique things about bond ballot language is that...
Excuse me. The parcel tax is 66 plus one vote?
66.7%, okay. Yes. Parcel taxes are at two-thirds.
Thank you.
And Prop 39 bonds are 55. There are also other kinds of bonds that would go at two-thirds, but you don't find most districts go for those types of bonds.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, one of the unique things about bond ballot language is... it doesn't make the price tag clear, right? Naturally, voter support for a revenue measure is going to depend in part on what the tax implications are for their household. And bond ballot language just talks about an aggregate bond amount they're authorizing, $130 million. It's not clear to me as a property owner what $130 million means. And so in the space of the poll, we want to make it clear, number one, bonds do mean taxes. Number two, we wanted to test a series of possible tax rates or tax implications to their home that could be associated with the bond so that we have an understanding of how sensitive is support for your bond measure in your community based on that price tag. And the way we do that first is what you see here on this slide is we talk about the tax implications as a rate per 100,000 of assessed valuation. That's the traditional way you talk about the tax implications of a bond measure. And we tested four different rates. We start at $54 per $100,000 of assessed valuation. We then went to 44, 34, and 29, depending on their level of support for the earlier options. And as you can see, the higher the price tag, the less support you have for this bond, right? At $54, only 37% of voters said they would support that. At $44, it ticks to 39%. When you get below $35, you hit 52%. At $29, you hit 53%. What I look for typically when I'm doing this type of research and talking with districts is you want to have a tax measure where you're right around that 55% mark. You don't have to have 65. You don't want to be at 47, certainly. You want to have it somewhere around 55. That's an appropriate threshold. And the reason for that is the nature of the question is we're kind of putting the blinders on somebody and we're saying, forget about what we're going to build, forget about the benefits. I want to focus your attention on the price tag. I want to make this conversation about the money. And we want to know that we're choosing a tax rate that if the conversation becomes about the money, we're still in a comfortable position. We still have our 55%. So here is the results of this suggest that that tax rate is around $29, right? Now, the other thing we've learned in doing this type of research is not everybody knows what assessed valuation means, right? And people have a tendency to overestimate the AV for their property. They tend to think market rate and not assessed valuation. And so we also ask, we talk about the tax implications another way. And on this slide, you see on the left bar, we said, let me put it another way. If you knew that this measure would cost the typical homeowner about $146 per year, would you vote yes or no on this school bond measure? And as you can, the $146 per year, by the way, is the $54 tax rate multiplied times the median AV for a residential property in your district, and that's how you get to $146 per year. So if you had a $54 tax rate, the typical property owner in your community would pay $146. And what you see here is that when you ask it that way, you get an improved response. You wind up with about 49% of folks who said that they would support that compared to, say, 37% at the $54 tax rate, but it's still not at that 55% mark. You also then to the right, we test the $29 tax rate, multiply that out. It comes up to $79 per year, and what you find is there we have support that's right around 60%, and compare that to, say, the 53% we found at $29. So what this tells us is it's important to do the math for folks, right? It helps them understand the tax implications of this bond in a way that they don't understand when you talk about it as a rate per 100,000 of assessed valuation. And when they understand what that bottom line dollar impact is, it tends to give them, tends to lead to more support for the bond than otherwise. Okay. So from this point in the interview the survey, we go on to what we call our projects and programs section, and the idea here is really twofold. Number one is we're now going to start to educate this respondent more about the types of improvements that would be funded by your measure, right? There, up till this point, we only had that 75-word ballot statement. You can only say so much in 75 words. Here we get to unpack this proposal into all the projects you see here on this list, and in that way, we're informing them about your proposal. The other thing it allows us to do is to understand what are your voters' priorities for how they would like this money to be spent if it were to be successful, and which of these projects may be further down the list. And what you see here in your community is something that's actually very typical of what we've been seeing, in particular this election cycle, for most districts. Top of the list, number one, providing classrooms, labs, and equipment for career and technology education classes so students are prepared for college and in-demand jobs like in fields like health sciences, engineering, and skilled trades. So career tech, number one. Number two, student safety and campus security improvements. Number three, repairing and replacing deteriorating roofs, plumbing, heating, ventilation, electrical systems. Those are your basic repairs to your facilities, right? And number four, providing facilities, equipment, technology to support high-quality instruction in math, science, engineering, and technology. So STEM, right? So career tech, STEM, safety and security, and basic repairs to your facilities. Those were the top four of those that tested. And this gives you a sense of if you're going to build a project list for this bond, right, you want to take some direction from your voters in terms of how you might prioritize that project list and what it is you fund. Now, if the board were to choose to place a measure on a ballot, there's going to be an election cycle, right? And during that election cycle, there's going to be a lot of discussion and debate in this community about your proposal, right? You're going to have folks who are supportive of your schools, who believe in this bond effort and the need, will stand up and advocate to their neighbors and friends about why this measure is needed and why you should vote yes. You might also have some opponents, right? Folks who stand up and don't agree with this bond, think it's a bad idea, and will argue to the community that this is something we shouldn't be supporting. For this to be a reliable gauge of the feasibility of your bond measure, we need to be able to simulate that type of discussion and debate in the space of the interview. So we know not only where your voters on the natural, which was that initial ballot test, but what happens to support for your measure once they've heard both the positive and negative arguments that could be they could be exposed to in the months leading up to Election Day. And so we do that first by testing positive arguments. And so for each of the arguments you see on that slide, we simply said, told voters that supporters of the measure say blank, you insert a positive argument. Do you think this is a very convincing, somewhat convincing, or not at all convincing reason to support the measure? And what you see is a lot of the positive arguments resonate. In fact, there's all of them have over 70% of your voters say that that's at least a somewhat convincing reason to support the measure. At the top of the list, however, there are a couple that kind of make sense in relation to the projects that I just mentioned were the priorities of your voters. Number one was a little bit of a history lesson. Most of our schools were built more than 60 years ago and require ongoing maintenance improvements so our schools can continue to serve our community well. That was your number one positive, followed by, if we want our students to succeed in college and careers, they must be skilled in the use of today's technologies and have a solid background in science, math, and technology. This measure will make it possible. So that ties back to that career tech item I mentioned earlier. Now, at this point in the survey, voters have heard a lot more about your proposal, right? So they've heard, after the initial ballot test, they heard about the tax rates that were being considered for the measure, and you saw that we tested some tax rates that were above their tax threshold. They also learned more about the projects that would be funded and the positive arguments, and so we circle back with them and we say, all right, where do you stand now? And what you see is support ticks down about 2 points. So at this point, you're sitting at 67%. That's largely a reflection of the tax rates, right? That we tested some tax rates that were outside the comfort zone of some of your voters. And so for them, they're factoring that in. We didn't make it certain what that tax rate would be, and you're checking in at 67%. Now from here, we go to the negatives. And we test fewer negatives than we do positives, and there's a good reason for that. What we tend to find in bond election cycles is that the advocates of a measure tend to be larger in number, better organized, have more funds, and ultimately have a louder voice than the opposition. That isn't always the case, but that's typically the case. And so you simulate that in the space of a poll by testing fewer negatives. However, the negatives we test are designed to be hard-hitting negative arguments. They're designed to be the kind of arguments that we would expect an opponent to level against the measure. So, for example, number one here is an argument that says there will be $9 billion available from the state of California to improve schools next year. We don't need to raise our local taxes with a local bond, right? A little bit of a disingenuous argument. Obviously, to get your fair share of the $9 billion from the state, you need to have a local match. But if I'm a crafty opponent, right, I will play a little misdirection and have and hope that succeeds in reducing some support for a measure. The other one, the second one is don't be fooled. I'm sorry, the second one is this measure is unfair to seniors and others on fixed incomes. So you're going after that senior base. Third is don't be fooled, including interest. This bond will cost taxpayers more than $250 million and will take property owners more than 40 years to pay off. We can't afford this bond. So you're doing the math on the bond and you're not only including the total bond amount, you're adding in all the interest payments that are going to happen in the debt service over time, and that checks in around $250 million. So we test a series of negative arguments, and after that we come back and we say, now that you've heard it a bit more, where do you stand? And what you see is the negatives cool you down quite a bit, right? You wind up landing at that final ballot test at 54%. So you're kind of right on the bubble at that point between a win and a loss because you need 55% to be successful. So all the questions up till this point are part of our standard methodology that we use. Now, there's also this consideration and concern about November as being a busy election, right? And that's going to have a lot of measures that are on the ballot. And so one of the questions that the district asked us to put on this survey was a question to try and get at what is the impact possibly of that November crowded ballot scenario. And so the question that was asked to be inserted into the survey was the following. There will be other statewide and local measures on the November ballot that, if approved by voters, will also increase the taxes your household pays. Knowing this, would you vote yes or no on the school bond we've been discussing? And here are the results. 36% at this point say yes to the bond, 43% say no, and about 20% say not sure or prefer not to answer. Obviously, the results of this question are very different than the results to some of the earlier questions in the poll, right? And so it puts us in this position of how do we deal with this, right? How do we deal with a survey that this question tells us you've got 36% and some of these other questions say you've got support at times that is up in the 60s? You know, my professional opinion is that although really well motivated, right, and I understand that the idea behind having that question in the survey, at the end of the day, it doesn't do a reliable job of measuring the scenario that we're trying to measure, which is this November ballot. And the reason I say that is following. One is, you know, we've never tested this question, so I have no empirical basis upon which to judge how accurate this question is in simulating that environment. We do, however, have the benefit of having asked all the other questions in this survey. That's our core methodology for hundreds of ballot measures in the state of California, and have found that those questions, right, through the final ballot test, are in fact a very reliable gauge of what the range of voter opinion is in your community depending on the scenario that we find on election day, right? And in fact, some of those elections are elections where there's not a lot on the ballot. Some of those elections are elections where there is a lot on the ballot. We've certainly been involved in a number of presidential elections where there's a lot of other things on the ballot. So and having tested those other questions, right, I feel comfortable saying, you know, I know that those are accurate. We've never tested this question. And so, again, while well-motivated, I don't think it's an accurate gauge of what you would expect if you actually put the measure on the November ballot.
Since you've done elections when there's been other multiple measures on the ballot, mm-hmm. how did the school bond elections go compared to when there wasn't anything else?
Yeah, we, as I mentioned before, we have an overall 93% success rate, right, for measures we recommend.
So the other 7% were when there were multiple measures?
Not necessarily. You know, the number one factor, and it's going to be in part of my conclusion here in I think shaping the potential for success, is not what else is on the ballot, right? It tends to be what's the community discussion like in the community about your measure, and do you get opposition or do you not get opposition? That is a much more dominant factor in explaining all the losses that we've had, right? And there haven't been many, right? Every single one of them has been a scenario where the opponents came out in force, right? And you had a measure that could win in a scenario where they had mild opposition or no opposition, but they faced much more rigorous opposition. And it's hard to be successful in measures like that when you face that kind of opposition, right? That's when we had losses. Now, I'm not saying you just disregard what else is on the ballot, because having a crowded ballot can matter in a number of ways. One is simply, it's a noisy election, right? There's a lot of other things out there, so you have to be able to get your message out above and beyond everybody else so that they understand. You don't want to be surprised that you have a bond measure on the ballot when they're reading down the ballot, right? You want them coming in knowing that's there, knowing some things about it, and they have some information upon which to make that decision. November is going to be a loud, noisy election, so it puts more pressure on the communication side. The other thing is, what else is on the ballot that could really compete with us, right? So I understand that there's been some discussion, I don't know if it's real or not, that maybe the city puts a measure on the ballot, right? There's some competition if you have overlapping local measures, certainly. In my experience, city measures do not trump school measures. School measures trump city measures, but nevertheless, it's something that creates a little bit of competition, right? The statewide school bond is actually kind of a double-edged sword, right? And the double edge to it is, on the one hand, it's a school bond ballot measure that says they're going to raise $9 billion, and it's for schools. And if I'm an uneducated voter, right, who just reads that and says, well, then there's all that money there, right? And so in that respect, it could be a negative. However, if you're good about communicating to the voters that say, look, in order for us to get, I mean, there's that opportunity. We can get millions and millions of dollars in matching money, but we have to have a local match to access it. it takes that potential negative and sort of judos it into a positive, right? And so we've been involved in other elections that have had similar type of statewide measures on there. It's really, does that measure create competition, or does it create an opportunity, right, to explain how we need our measure to get our fair share of that measure, right? The Prop 31 is kind of a, if you understand it, is not a big deal, because there was a sales tax component to the original Prop 30, right? That is not part of what I call the son of Prop 30 that they're thinking about, right? The other measure that's going to be on the ballot, because it's only, they're only leaving the income tax piece of that for the wealthy in there. So you have to earn $500,000. Your effective tax rate has to be, your effective earnings have to be $500,000 or more for that extra income tax piece to kick in. So, you know, it's a pretty small percentage of the total population that makes that kind of money, so it doesn't have that same kind of an effect. So here's what I think we're staring at as far as what these results mean from...
With the Prop 30, though, are they going to look at that and say, well, you're going to have additional resources if that passes, and it's not going to cost me more?
It's possible. You know, the Prop 31 is interesting because we actually had a number of districts that were looking at parcel taxes, right, at the time. So we've done parcel taxes for a number of the South Pasadena, La Cañada, San Marino, those. And they were looking at parcel taxes in the same election environment, or sometimes right after Prop 30 was being considered. And the concern was, you know, this really steals our thunder, right? I mean, here we have, they're selling it too. They're overselling it. They're selling it as a silver bullet. At best, it's really a Band-Aid, right? It's all it's doing is patching. But that's not the way they, of course, talk about it when they talked about that measure. What we found was that there was initially a little bit of a drop, but then that was that. It bounced back. And so people understand, the one thing you know about the voters is, A, they don't trust the state of California, right, for a variety of reasons, probably well-earned. And if push comes to shove, they are going to support their local measure before they're going to support a statewide measure. But nevertheless, communication becomes important, right? There's some basic facts that would help a voter understand the differences here. Okay, so what does all this mean? I'm going to circle back first to that question that I mentioned at the outset is the main motivator for why we ask this type of, why we do this type of research, and that is this question of, is it feasible to move forward with a bond? And by feasible, I mean if you were to choose to place a measure on the upcoming ballot, does it have a reasonable chance of being successful? The answer to that is yes. A lot of things we want to see in place for a measure to be feasible are in place here. We saw that voters perceived that improving the quality of education was the number one issue in the community, right? Trumps all other issues. That translated into really strong natural support, meaning at first blush, when they read that 75-word ballot statement, how do they react? You had 69% say yes to that, right? You need 55%, so that's a great place to start. We saw that you had the projects that you're thinking of funding. Many of those were very popular, and the positive arguments resonated. Now, having said that, I think there's some important considerations. The first being that poll like this is a snapshot in time. It is not a crystal ball, right? It's not looking forward to election day and saying, on election day, you're going to get 69%. What determines what happens on election day is not what your poll says today. It's everything that happens from this point forward, right? And this is particularly important in your case, because what we found in your case is that although you have natural support for your bond is very high, it's not very resilient, right? And it tends to be moved quite a bit based on the information they encounter during the course of the interview. And so what that suggests is how this election cycle plays out is really going to have a strong shaping influence on, in terms of the presence of an advocacy campaign, presence of opposition, all those sorts of things is going to have a strong effect on what your ultimate turnout is. I have worked in communities where support is very solid. Like, I mean, you can't move it up and you can't move it down. It is what it is, right? Yours is much more variable. And so some of the things that are going to play into this factor is that, you know, how things play out in terms of election cycles. So some thoughts on that. Number one, as I already mentioned, November is going to be crowded, but more importantly, it's going to be noisy, right? I personally am less concerned about the other measures that are on the ballot as I am the fact that it's just a noisy election, right? So it's important that you can communicate in that noisy environment. District-funded education and outreach are important, right? So voters understand the need, the plan, and the accountabilities. You, as a district, cannot use public funds to advocate, but you can certainly use those funds to inform voters about the decision you're asking them to make. And that's an important piece here, because if they are surprised when they read down the ballot and see your bond, or they don't know anything about it, they don't understand your plan, right? They have no sense of what the needs are in the district for this thing. They're not in a position to vote yes, even if they're, you know, strong supporters of the schools. An independent advocacy campaign is also necessary to convey advocacy messages and be able to respond to events during the election cycle, as well as get out the vote. It isn't so much in this case that get out the vote doesn't mean get more voters to the polls who aren't going to go anyways, because the bottom line is there's going to be a high turnout. And if you're not willing to show up and vote for the president in this fascinating election cycle, right, you're probably not going to be motivated to come show up to vote for a school bond. It's more about making sure that they go down ballot, right, that they don't get lost after they vote for the president and some of these other offices, and suddenly there's a bunch of stuff in the middle that nobody ever pays attention to, right, and they just drop. We want them to go all the way to the bottom and make sure, because that's where your measure is going to appear. And then finally, and you can see from the polling results, you know, organized opposition is really the wild card, right? If you were to move forward with an election cycle without opposition, right, I think you're in a very good place to be successful. If you get organized opposition, I think it's going to be very difficult to be successful. And so that is really the wild card in all of this. I, at this point, end my presentation, and I certainly welcome questions from the board if there are any. Oh, wait, I got one more. Considerations also for the bond. Price tag, always important to keep that within the range that voters view as affordable. I see that as being a tax rate no more than $29 per $100,000 assessed valuation. So even though Prop 30 allows you to go to $60, you don't want to do that. I think you're going to have a hard time getting voter support for that kind of price tag. And then finally, from a project list perspective, we saw that, you know, the anchors really of voter support for this bond were in repairing your existing facilities, safety and security, career tech and STEM. So to the extent that you can make those themes present in your project list, you're creating a package that is in tune with what your voters are would be interested in supporting. So now I'm done, and I welcome questions.
It's all pretty clear, so.
President Polis, if I may?
Yes.
Just out of curiosity, if you go to page 14 or 12 of your presentation, we've talked about this. I've talked to individually some board members about this. The last negative argument on your survey, districts can't be trusted, money will be mismanaged, and won't build what promised. My experience has been, since I've been here, that's opposite of what I hear out in the community, which is this particular board, if anything, is ultra-conservative and trustworthy with the good of the people and money. So my question is that a common answer that you get when you go out? Is that lower than normal, or is that just people firing from the hip saying, you know, never trust government?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's important to remember that as good Americans, we are taught not to trust government, right? That's like one of the founding principles of our, you know, ethos here. So you tend to get that knee-jerk reaction, right? At the end of the day, though, their willingness or ability to trust you is sort of baked into the results you're seeing in the ballot test. If you had a voter base that didn't trust you to manage the money well and wisely, you're not going to get support for a bond like this, right? And we're tracking that kind of support. Now, having said that, it's often important to help those voters who are you're sort of a gray area for them, right? They don't know a lot about you as a public agency. And as a district, you're often tasked with communicating with parents, right? But a lot of voters are not parents. Typically, 4 out of 5, you know, do not have kids in your schools active at that time. Sometimes 3 out of 5. So it's important you communicate to them, and you might have to help them understand that you've been good stewards of their tax dollars, because they may not understand that at the moment, right? So that doesn't—I would say that's a knee-jerk reaction, but that doesn't mean so you just forget about the theme of financial, you know, accountability, because that becomes an important part. The other thing you will note is in the positive arguments, some of the arguments that do resonate are really around what are the accountability provisions that are built into a Prop 39 bond, right? So I may be a voter who is suspicious of government, doesn't, you know, concerned about government waste, concerned that if I support this measure, although I'm supportive of schools, I'm concerned my tax dollars aren't going to be used wisely. That's why Prop 39 has things like Citizen Oversight Committee, right, independent audits, right, reports to the community on how the funds are going to be spent. Those are part and requirements of a Prop 39 bond. Even if they weren't required, we would argue you want to have them in there because it gives confidence to those voters who may not know a lot about you, right, and they're, you're still going to have that gray area with some voters that they're nevertheless comfortable saying yes if that's their inclination.
I have a question. So typically in the election cycle when you're putting forth a bond, when do, or if you can answer this, when do you begin to see opposition start to form?
It just depends community to community. I mean, we had a bond this cycle that had zero opposition and nobody even bothered to write an argument against the bond, right? So, I mean, that's the, if you're a pro-bond person and want to have something pass, that's the ideal scenario, right? Most communities, you're going to get some, what I would call disorganized opposition, right? You're going to have letters to the editor, you're going to have people make comments, because not everybody's going to be supportive of a bond, right? So you're going to have that kind of discussion. That's different than organized opposition, right? When you have organized opposition that is, you know, doing email blasts and hitting social media, lawn signs, you know, those types of things, that's where it becomes a very different dynamic. And so part of deciding on do you move forward with a bond measure, right, is in part looking ahead into that election environment, saying, okay, our polls tells us, right, that we have strong natural support in the community, but it's not resilient, right? So we need to ask ourselves as a board when we look into the future, what kind of path do we see to election day? Do we think that we can do our side of the deal, meaning we can do a good job informing voters about what the need is and the plan is? We see that there's some folks who are willing to step up and advocate on behalf of this measure to kind of keep the ball rolling moving forward. Those are the things you can control. But you do kind of want to put your, you know, finger in the wind and sense, are we also potentially facing organized opposition or not? Because in absence of that, I think you're in a good place to be, very good place to be successful. If you have that, it's a toss-up. I mean, it's kind of anything goes at that point, right? And so that's one of the things you need to consider about whether or not you move forward.
Typically, are there groups that tend to oppose such bonds?
It can be, I mean, sure. I mean, there have been cycles, for example, where, you know, a few cycles ago in particular, and going back to like 2010, where you could have organized Tea Party opposition, and they make a blanket an area, right? So it's not just about your district, it's about other districts and other measures, and they do a lot of anti-government, anti-tax kind of outreach. That was, you know, a bigger issue a couple elections ago than it has been more recently, but there's that. You know, I've worked with districts that, I mean, you kind of want to think about what your history has been and who in your community you might expect would be a potential opponent, right? And think about, you know, are they likely to you know, come after this or not, right? Every community is a little unique in that respect.
Hi, thank you very much for your very thorough presentation. I appreciate it. I have a few questions. Going back to page 6 on the initial ballot test and looking at 69% of the likely voters are in support, and we asked questions about a bond. So I'm assuming because we're so close to a parcel tax, the recommendation for our district would be bond versus trying to go after a parcel tax because yeah. We'd be hitting it so close. What's your professional?
I think this is apples and oranges on this. The question was in terms of a bond,
uh-huh.
And so the support levels we're seeing at 69% for a bond reflect that kind of a ballot. A parcel tax could be very different in terms of the level of support for that, depending on what you're putting in there, right? But if we were just to say, pretend for a second that you tested a parcel tax and you had 69%. You know, parcel tax are a lot harder to pass, right, because you have that higher hurdle.
Higher threshold, right.
And a lot of the ones that we've been involved with, we've actually only lost one ever. But I can tell you, walking in on election day, almost every one of them had polling results that were within the margin of error of what you need to be successful, right? Because it's hard to get beyond 69%, right? When you think about, if you think about the electoral profile in your community and the makeup of Republicans and Democrats and conservatives and liberals and everything else, it's hard to have any proposal where you're going to have agreement by two-thirds of people, much less a proposal that's going to raise your taxes, right? And so even when you are successful with a parcel tax, typically your polling doesn't get much above two-thirds, right? The advantage of having bond at 55 is that there are plenty of instances where we've been involved with where the polling was well beyond the 55%, stayed well beyond the 55%. And in that scenario, you feel really confident going to election day that, hey, we've got a 10-point buffer, right? I think I've maybe worked with two school districts ever that have had a 10-point buffer on a parcel tax.
Right. It's very close. I know our last bond, we had a 72% pass rate. So that was really, really good. But again, you don't know with this coming election. So that leads me to my next question, that currently when voters are looking at their tax bill, they're currently looking at our 2000, right, bond. Mm-hmm. And so in your professional opinion, how will that play into successfully moving this one? They're still looking at one that's there.
Mm-hmm. What I have found, first of all, most voters don't look at their tax bill like that. Right? Let's just be honest. They don't.
I was going to say, how about when we're walking door to door? And
my experience is they don't. My experience also is, you know, we've worked with districts. I mean, your bond is, what, 16 years old?
Yes.
15 years old?
2000. Yes, 16.
Not that, you know, the tax payment they're paying on that is insignificant, because it's not. But what we tend to find is most people wouldn't be thinking, hey, that's a 16-year-old bond, and I'm very conscious of what it is I'm paying on that. And moreover, 16 years ago is kind of ancient history when it comes to getting funds for your school district. I've worked with districts that are, I mean, Torrance is a great example of this, right? They'd gone out a couple times and lost. We were then hired another consultant to come in and look at the feasibility of bond. We helped them pass two bonds on the same ballot, and they were successful. They came back 4 years later, put two more bonds on the ballot, and were successful. So we passed four bonds in 4 years for them. And so what that kind of gives you a sense is, I mean, that's the extreme example, right? But that the fact that you've passed a bond recently isn't insignificant, but what's more important is you tell your story about this bond and what your needs are, right? And whether you had a bond 16 years ago or you had a bond last year, it's more about what are you going to do with this fund? What are the needs there? Can you make a compelling case to the community that this is something they should support and it's priced affordably, right? That's really the need, you know, what has to happen in order to be successful with this. And the other things, although not insignificant, are really sort of second-tier considerations.
Okay. Then the last question that I have, that it was back in the late 80s, I think it was 87, help me, ladies, that we experienced bankruptcy. The district had experienced a bankruptcy.
Really?
In 1987.
I was in high school.
Me too. So when we're looking at page 12, when Dr. Hinman brought up page 12 and districts can't be trusted, I was looking in this document, what was the age sampling, because we may have some voters, even though we've proven that we could be trusted with our money, we're very conservative, we've weathered hard times. 87 taught us a lot of very important lessons. I'm just curious if any of those 50 and older, 55 and older, who not only lived here but experienced it, if that's going to factor in this time around, and what would your recommendations be?
Well, I think that, first of all, that person, right, is like looking for needles in a haystack. So to give you an example, we break it down in terms of registration dates. So when they register to vote in your district, right, which is an indicator of how long they've been of age to some degree and lived in the district.
Okay.
Right? Yeah, before 2001, so that's 13 years after the 87, right?
Uh-huh.
26% of voters had registered in your district prior to 2001. So forgetting age for a second, although they're somewhat related, as you keep going back, I don't have it here, but I could parse it out. My guess is you're talking about maybe 10% of your voters would have that combo.
Now, I feel very confident because, again, back in 2000, it passed with 72%. And that was much closer to 87 than we are now. We're quite a bit, we're 29 years away.
I would say that the two parts of that. One is, I don't think the bankruptcy in 1987 becomes an issue that gets any traction, would be my guess. But the other piece of
bankruptcy.
What's that?
It wasn't quite a bankruptcy.
Quiet bankruptcy, right. And there's been,
we didn't get that far.
You know, what's really interesting about voters is they will separate things in their mind between and their willingness to support school bonds and school measures relative to what's going on. I mean, we worked in an extreme example a couple of years ago, 2 years ago, where there was a board member who was indicted for a whole laundry list of very bad things, pandering, pimping, attempted murder.
Wow.
Right? Board member. And insisted on staying on the board. And they had no mechanism for pulling them off the board, right? So you look at that as say, how on God's green earth can we be successful in that scenario? Well, we'd already been active in doing research related to this, and so we had to go back and do some tracking. And what we found was voters separated it, right? They didn't see that that board member was reflective of what the district is about. And I don't remember what the passage rate on that was, but
7%.
Yes.
Wow.
So the community came out strong in favor of schools. So I don't think the bankruptcy 30 years ago is on the radar screen at all. But I also would say I don't think your bond measure in 2000 passing at 72% is necessarily, oh, well, then we're going to pass this, no problem, right?
It's not
different
a slam
time, dunk. Different right. scenario. You know, you have to deal with the environment that you're in now, not what was going on then.
Okay, good. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that.
Now, does the timing of the election make a difference? Because I know I'm only one person, but I will be very aware of what my tax bill is in November because it's going to be mailed to me, and I'm going to have to pay it in early December, or I'm going to be penalized. Mm-hmm. So I am going to be going online and making that payment and seeing it come out of my bank account. Does that make a difference? I might not be so aware of it when I just haven't opened it or just paid it.
Yeah, that's a good question. We do a lot of elections that are in November, right? Whether they're on an odd year or an even year. And so that's always the case. Interestingly enough, there's only one period of time, aside from like sort of Christmas holidays, that we don't interview for revenue measures. And that's in April, right? Because that's the main
really
tax bill, right? Because what we found is you get an artificially low read compared to what happens on Election Day, right? And so in that sense of timing, I haven't found that because, again, we do these polls oftentimes 6-9 months ahead of an election cycle, and we've, you know, the results tend to fall within that range between our first ballot test and our final ballot test that we're seeing in support, depending on how the scenario plays out. And the fact that it's a November measure or a June measure doesn't influence that. What does influence it, however, it doesn't influence it in terms of the reliability of the polling relative to what you see on Election Day. What can influence it is the turnout, right? And that's an important one. And one of the things you see in your community is that, and it kind of makes sense, is that that higher the turnout is, right, the more folks are coming to the polls, the more the profile of your electorate changes, and it tends to change in a more tax-friendly way, right? This is not unusual. This is why, frankly, when you look around the state, there are so many school districts positioning themselves for November, right? Because they're trying to take advantage of that more tax-friendly electorate. So let me give you a little example. If you look at the initial ballot test first, in your community, so initially, on that initial ballot test, we found among your likely November voters, you're not even going to see this there. I'm just going to read it out of the body of the report. But overall, you have 69% support, as we talked about, right? That's among your likely November voters. If you filter out voters who are showing up in June and just look at them, right? So I mean, in other words, turn around. If you filter out the voters who are only showing up in November and not showing up in June, right? So these are the people who show up in November, don't show in June. And you look at your June universe, your support is 65%. So about 4 points lower among voters who were likely to participate in this recent June election. By the end of the survey, right, after all is said and done, in the likely November universe, we have 54%, right, as we talked about. Those June voters, right, that were likely to participate in June, 45%. So this is consistent with what I was talking about, which is as you shrink your turnout, your electorate tends to be older, more conservative, more likely to be a homeowner, less tax friendly, and it makes that, you know, makes switching the time to say from November to say a June environment. Now you're dealing with a sort of trading challenges for challenges, right? You have less noise, right? You may have less competition, but now you have an electorate that is now less tax friendly on the natural.
Though in the recent June election, when I was following the local school districts, all of them passed their bonds.
Yeah, this
Bell had the largest.
Absolutely, it is. It's been a wild, wild cycle, right? Because 6 months ago, right, when we were doing this work, and everyone would look at June, and everyone would get chills running up the back of their spine about tax measures. Why? Because the thought was, well, the Democrats are going to have it sewn up, right? Hillary will have sewn up the nomination a long time ago. And the Republicans at that point were an all-out brawl, right? And so the thought was that brawl was going to continue toward nomination. And when it got to California, when we had our June primary, there would be a lot of people wanting to come out for the Republican nomination and vote for their person, right? Democrats wouldn't have a lot of reason to be out, right? What ended up happening was the reverse of that in some ways, right? Trump's got it sewn up. Not a lot of interest in for Republicans to show up necessarily because they only have one choice, right? Meanwhile, the Democrats are busy still, you know, competing. And so that had a sort of beneficial effect to June in a way that you don't typically see, yes. Right? But it was also something you'd have a hard time predicting 5 months in advance.
Correct. I was very pleased at the success that other districts had.
Yep.
And that was interesting how you just explained why.
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
Yeah. Turnout becomes a big part of... I mean, turnout becomes a big part in explaining what happens on Election Day, and as does sort of the messaging on both sides, right? That's really those two things together are 80% of the puzzle.
Any other questions?
I just have one question on your methodology of study. You did... interviews on phone and emails?
Correct.
So you said average 17 minutes?
17 minutes on phone. It's a lot shorter on email because you can see it.
Do you know how many you did phone meetings compared to emails? How many?
I don't offhand. I know that I think we're at least 175 phone. I'd have to double check that.
So out of how many voters did you ask? And how
actually,
many
it was probably two. It was 200 phone, actually. It was 200 phone, and the remainder was email.
So everyone that you got in touch with got... answer back to you.
The way it works is the phone work, we will recruit by phone, and we're calling them to, you know, solicit their participation, right? Not everybody says yes, right? But, and so if somebody says no, I replace them with somebody who shares their same profile, and we get an interview from that second person, let's say. So that forms the foundation of the sample. For the online piece, the way it works is we have then a sample of voters for whom we also have email addresses, and we can either call them or we can email them. Some people will respond to the email and click in and respond that way. If they don't click in, we know that, and then they become part of the phone sample too. So we're for them, they have two ways of getting of recruitment, not just one.
Any other questions? I appreciate you coming out.
Thank you. I appreciate the afternoon.
Good job. Thank you.
Thank you.
We will be adjourning into closed session. Is there anybody who would like to speak to anything on the closed session agenda? Seeing none. At 6:03.